Hi, I'm Mansadi Sipeka for All Africa, and welcome to the first of many discussions around what peace-building practitioners are doing to help end conflict on the African continent, where violence and instability have changed the lives of millions of people. Our first journey is through South Sudan, the Mozambique, and lastly, the Sahel region. But we first have to understand what it means to build peace, and where it seems almost hopeless. Woman peace and security practitioner and executive director of the African Leadership Center, Dr. Shivaya Busumanyoni, has been in the business of building peace on the continent in her role as executive director of the African Leadership Center and as a peace practitioner for decades. Shivaya, welcome. So Shivaya, before we get into the area of South Sudan, if you can just explain to us exactly what is a peace practitioner?
Good morning, everyone, and good morning to my fellow panelists. Good morning, Mansadi. So maybe just to clarify, so I'm currently the director of the African Leadership Center, and I also work in the area of women, peace and security. Specifically, that's my own kind of research area and area of practice.
Sure.
I think as a, I don't know, I wouldn't quite call myself a peace practitioner, but more someone who has been working in the area of women, peace and security, both in a research capacity, but also in practice. So directly on the ground and working on issues that relate to women in conflict, how women are affected by conflict, but also women's participation in conflict. And that's linked to the work I do at the work we do at the African Leadership Center, which is a center it's a research and a training center. It's our focus is on young people, young Africans, who we see as the next generation of leaders on the continent and globally, dealing with issues that sit at the nexus of peace, security, and development. And we do that in a number of ways. But one of our flagship programs is a program specifically focused on young African women in peace and security. And that program involves a year's training of academic and non-academic training in the field of peace, security, and development. Many of these young African women are coming from conflict-affected settings or contexts, or they are, you know, they live in insecure contexts or contexts where there is violence or violent conflict. And so I think going back to your question of what it means to be a peace practitioner, I think that it's very broad. It can be defined in a number of ways, but I think it's essentially anyone who is working or contributing to further peace or stability or well-being in a society, furthering the freedom from the threat of violence, the freedom from the insecurity of either the physical being or any other aspect of the of human life, I think, essentially. And I think it's people who are working together with others to ensure that, as we say at the African Leadership Center, that people are able to make choices about how they will live well and live long.
And I know you mentioned the projects that you are currently doing. How have they, or your work with around the peace sector, shaped what is happening on the continent right now?
You know, that's again a difficult question to answer, because how do you attribute the small contribution you're making in an entire continent, a continent as diverse and as rapidly moving and changing as the African continent? And that's especially true when we think about issues of peace and insecurity on our continent. I mean, every day at any point, you know, something is changing. I think the contribution that our center has made, really, we have been around for about 10 to 13 years in different iterations. And we have trained over 124 young Africans who sit across the globe in various institutions, be they academic, be they multilateral, government, civil society, research, and scholarly institutions. And many of these people are contributing in, you know, whether someone is working in the office of the ombudsperson at the World Bank or is an ambassador for their country to another country or is in the military or is in a peacekeeping mission, of which many of our alumni are at the moment. So they're contributing to the peace agenda, the security agenda across the globe, I think, in different ways. I mean, some at the moment, we have two alumni, for instance, who are involved in various ways in some of the peace agreement mechanisms in South Sudan. You know, others who are who have been in peace missions in Darfur and other places. So I think our work really is to provide the foundation what many of our alumni go on to do with what they have been trained in, they apply in the various settings where they find themselves.
So let's move on to the topic of South Sudan. We know that there was a recent agreement signed between President Salva Kiir and his opposition leader, Riek Machar. And we know that past agreements have failed or have ended in a lot more conflict than peace. The one that triggered the civil war in 2013 led to about 400,000 people losing their lives and millions being displaced. So the recent agreement that was signed, Salva Kiir himself said, "Peace is finally here." Now, in your opinion, Shabai, do you believe is close for the South Sudanese people?
This question is interesting in the sense that I don't think you can necessarily give a yes or no answer. How close or how far peace is, I think what we do know is that we are yet to be at a place where the South Sudanese can say with certainty that they know that they can live well and they can live long. I think while the peace agreement that was eventually signed, the revitalized agreement that was eventually signed, has ushered in a period of relative absence of big battles, large-scale battles between what we could identify as government forces and the opposition, as you will, there is still an absence of peace. There's still no guarantee that the majority of South Sudanese are free from the threat of violence at any given time. And I think we just have to look, especially at the situation of women and children. I think the fact that we have high numbers of sexual violence that still continues, and also in certain parts of the country, localized conflict, or what is called oftentimes as intercommunal violence, which has underlying political linkages that linked to the bigger political conflict that has been going on since 2013. And there are numerous reports from numerous organizations that point to this. This issue is still an issue of concern on the agenda of the UN Security Council, even the African Union's Peace and Security Council. And so I think we cannot say that peace has finally come, especially if South Sudanese people themselves cannot say that with confidence.
So in your opinion, what would be the best peace-building strategy for the South Sudanese people? What is the way forward here?
You know, I think one of the biggest challenges when it comes to intervening or engaging in a context where the society is at war, in conflict with itself, one of the things that I think there's always a rush to have mediators, and mediators at a very high level from outside of the context. there's always a rush to create a peace table, a physical space around which those who wield the most power in the situation can sit around. Now, who are those who wield the most power? It's usually men. It's men with guns or men with access to guns. It's rarely ever the people who are most affected by this violence, who are most affected by the conflict. And very rarely are those people ever asked what they want, what they desire. And we call this establishing mutuality, right? So being able to understand what is it that the people who you would eventually lead, if you are a leader, what is it that they want, and how is it that we can get to that common goal together? I think in the case of South Sudan, my own opinion is that for many, many years, there has not been a sustainable way of understanding and getting to know what it is ordinary South Sudanese want and how and what they see as the best way to get to that place. There are many dialogues, there are many mediations, but when you look at who those involve, predominantly involves men, it involves men with guns and men with access to power and resources.
So the UN's Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, they speak of civilians that are under serious threat, obviously, namely the women and the girls who are abducted, raped, sexually assaulted or enslaved or forcibly married. So what is the ALC's role in highlighting these atrocities?
So as I said to you again, you know, we are a research and training institution, so we are not so much... we wouldn't so much be highlighting those atrocities in the period as they happen, because we do more of training the people who would go to perhaps undertake investigations or documentation or participate in some of those mechanisms or processes where that kind of work is being done. However, we do, on the research side of what we do house data on peace. We have what we call the African Leadership Center Data Lab, which is a repository of data on peace and security on the African continent since 1960. And we have huge amounts of data that would also include data on this kind of thing. So any researcher, any African researcher doing any kind of work on this particular topic, for instance, would be able to access some of that data that we house. We also work in collaboration with various institutions or mechanisms where research is concerned. So we would not necessarily, you know, we wouldn't be like your Human Rights Watch or Amnesty who would, you know, put out press statements, etc., on these kinds of atrocities. But our work is more sort of in the background and providing, you know, it's part of the link or the chain in establishing the kinds of facts that would go into a report like that, that would say, you know, and it would be go into a report like that as secondary data, not necessarily ourselves doing the work.
I know this situation seems or appears bleak, but are there any positive outcomes to this to trying to build peace in the region?
I think certainly there are. And I think for me, what is the most exciting is the way that communities, activists within the local context have gained not only confidence, but how they innovate all the time. And this is the kind of information that we at the African Leadership Center try to excavate. We try to really focus on the lived realities and lived experiences of the people who come through our doors, and many of them coming from many of these contexts. And I think what we haven't seen enough of, and what we need to build on, is the practices, the strategies, the approaches, the knowledge generation and knowledge production of local actors in many conflict-affected contexts. Because women, for instance, last year in South Sudan, at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, with lockdowns and many restrictions on movements, there were spikes, as there were in many other parts of the world, of gender-based violence, violence against women, etc. and to see how local activists came together to actually put pressure on the government to respond, to do something, but at the same time respond to the COVID pandemic, and also setting up, you know, groups and networks where information could travel very quickly and assistance could very quickly reach those who needed it. So I think there's a huge gap in terms of our knowledge on many of these innovations and actions that are being taken at a local level, and that needs to be highlighted. But that's something I would definitely celebrate.
Well, thanks so much for that, Shiva. I'd like to bring in David here. As we move on to the topic of Mozambique and the conflict that is happening there and what's been happening this current week. As we've seen on all the news agencies the past week, and especially this weekend alone, there's been several deaths and civilians are still missing, displaced civilians, intense fighting in the past week. It appears to mark an escalation of fighting amongst government forces, local rebels, and perhaps the participation of international extremists who are taking advantage of maybe the poverty and desperation of the region's people. I mean, as we sit here, I know the town of Parma is quite tense at the moment. And so, David Machinya, welcome. As I said earlier, recently, you are the South African researcher at Amnesty International. You wrote a piece calling on SADC leaders to urgently intervene in this violence, this violent extremism that's happening in Mozambique. I would just like to know, and obviously want to spend more time on this because it seems like Mozambique has pretty much just exploded over the past few days in terms of the violence. Why is the violence like it is?
Thank you for this conversation. Well, to answer that question, I think first I need to give a background of, you know, the province of Cape Delgado itself, which informs what's happening at the moment. As you know, Mozambique became independent 45 years ago in 1975. And the province of Cape Delgado back then, during the colonial era, it was a neglected space. And this was carried forward. It continued after independence. That means the people of Cape Delgado have been neglected by the current government. There's been little investment in social services, such as education, construction of infrastructure such as roads and bridges so that people can live their lives and trade with each other. And there's been little investment in health services, water and sanitation distribution infrastructures. That means for all these years, people have relied on the land, the natural ecosystem around them, to provide for themselves, for their livelihoods, for food, for water, for housing, medicinal plants, for fishing, even for their own cultural identity, because the land isn't just a commodity. It is also a cultural element that bestows a sense of identity to people. So this is what has been happening in the past 45 years after independence. What happens is that about, you know, 10 years ago or so, the province of Cape Delgado showed to have large reserves of natural resources, including gold, rubies, graphite, and there's also large reserves of natural gas. So it attracted not only the government to come to Cape Delgado, so to speak, but also multinational corporations interested in exploiting these resources. So the multinational corporations and the government work together to displace people, dislocate them from their land in order to make room for these business ventures. In fact, in a district called Montepuez, in one of my trips there, I spoke with local government authorities who were complaining that the entire district of Montepuez has been licensed to a mining company and other multinational corporations interested in mining rubies there, so much so that there's no more land left for people to live in, for people to grow food, for people to collect construction material. We are talking about housing, okay? So this is a serious problem, and the local authorities were complaining to us about it, saying there isn't much that we can do about it because the orders come from the central government to license these lands to multinational corporations. In fact, if you look at the land, at the map of Cape Delgado, you will see that the entire province of Cape Delgado, except the natural reserve there, has been licensed to mining companies for mining projects and mining prospections. Absolutely nothing for people to grow their food, to continue to maintain their livelihoods. Now, I have said that I've said at the beginning that there was no investment in education. Lack of investment in education for the past 45 years meant that the people of Cape Delgado, especially young people, were left without skills. There was no skills development, which means not only are they unemployed, but they are also unemployable in the growing mining and gas industry in the province. So they are standing aside and look outsiders, those who come from elsewhere, within and without the country, benefiting from the development of these mining and gas projects. Now, that creates huge discontent, especially among young people. Yeah. And mind you, it's not only Cape Delgado. All those provinces in northern Mozambique, including Niassa and Nampula, are facing the same issues. So the insurgents have been able to recruit young people, not only from within Cape Delgado, but from Nampula and Niassa, and they've joined the ranks, and they are part of these insurgents, you know, that are creating problems in northern Mozambique. And if I could quickly add, there's been a tendency to emphasize, especially among international scholars and within the government of Mozambique, the tendency to emphasize the external element of this conflict, arguing that it's external, you know, forces from ISIS that are invading and violating Mozambique's sovereignty and creating problems for the country, Islamic insurgents. Well, Islamic insurgents actually are young people that have been recruited due to these local grievances from within these three provinces. Those are overwhelming majority that are part of the fighters that are creating problems in northern Cape Delgado.
So what would be the most effective intervention here? I mean, it seems like there's calls for international help, for SADC to come in and do something. What is, in your opinion, the most effective intervention?
Well, in my view, exclusive reliance on military intervention is counterproductive, is not enough, because violence only begets violence. Death begets death. That's what's happening at the moment. Yeah. We have said the problem of economic and social exclusion of the region is deeply ingrained in Cape Delgado. So rather than simply relying on militarism, it's very important to have a more comprehensive, a multidisciplinary approach that will bring development projects and programs to build education infrastructure, the health infrastructure, roads and bridges for people to be able to move their goods and trade with others within the province and elsewhere in the countries and beyond. And these are the development projects that could contribute toward the restoration of peace and security in the region. In addition to that, I think it's very important to open up the province of Cabo Delgado and allow more access to humanitarian organizations to deal with a growing humanitarian crisis in the region. At the moment, as we speak, humanitarian organizations are having problems coming to Mozambique. Mm-hmm. The government is reluctant or does not want to issue visas for these humanitarian organizations to come into the country. We also believe that it's very important for the government to open up the province of Cabo Delgado to human rights monitors like myself and others. Investigators and journalists, the media, to enter the province in order to allow people to speak directly to the international community, to speak directly to the country, and tell their own stories, tell their own trauma. And it's very important for us to be aware of what's happening in Cabo Delgado. Because when you deny the victims of this conflict their right to be known by speaking, and the right of the public to know them, then you are actually killing them for the second time. Because death isn't only a physical death. Death is also not being known. Your story is not known. You can't reach out to others and speak who might be sympathetic to your plight and, you know, provide assistance. So the Mozambican government is denying this. And we believe that, you know, one of the ways in which an effective intervention could be put in place is to allow the people of Cabo Delgado to speak directly to the international community. I might just add that the government of Mozambique itself, in principle, should make policy decisions on the basis of knowledge, on the basis of information. And if researchers and human rights monitors and journalists are not allowed, on what basis then is the Mozambican government making its decisions about Cabo Delgado?
Yeah.
On what basis is the government of Mozambique designing policies and implementing in Cabo Delgado so that peace and security can be restored in the country? So practically, the people of Cabo Delgado, in terms of information about them, are not visible, not only to the outside world, but also to the Mozambican government. Let them make the people visible, speak, let all this information come out. In our view, that would be the most effective way of intervening in the direction of restoring peace and security in the region.
Why the denial of access to humanitarian organizations such as yourselves, journalists, and whoever's trying to report on what's going on there in Cabo Delgado specifically?
The best people to answer that question, you know, senior official government officers in Mozambique. Yeah. Because they are the ones who have taken this decision on the basis of what? Our question is, what are they hiding? What are they trying to keep under the rug? Now, our research has shown that there are serious allegations of human rights violations and war crimes. And mass graves. Is this that the government is trying to hide from the international community? Because if you want to restore peace and security in the country, let the truth come out. Otherwise, there will be no reconciliation. Otherwise, we will continue to have a conflict. When people don't see their pain, their truth recognized and dealt with, then the resentment will continue. The tendency to pick up arms and fight for recognition will always be there. So, you know, this is what we are asking ourselves. Why are they preventing us from entering the area, conducting investigations, monitor human rights, document what's happening? What are they trying to hide? Those are the questions that we ask ourselves.
Okay, so as Amnesty International and the work that you do, how does you contribute to peace building in Mozambique?
So one of the things that are happening in Mozambique is that you have extreme inequality, regional inequalities. You have central, northern, and southern Mozambique. In Mozambique, you have the highest concentration of mineral wealth in central and northern Mozambique, but particularly in northern Mozambique. Central and northern Mozambique have the highest concentration of the population in the country.
Yeah.
This poses a dilemma because the country is governed from the south in Maputo. And this mineral wealth that is concentrated in these two regions tends to benefit the minority, the political elite that is based in Maputo in the south. And people can see this. They can see the south getting prosperous in their view, and they can see themselves becoming impoverished as they lose more and more of their land that is being given to multinational corporations to mine without their benefit, in fact, without even their informed consent. That creates resentment. That's inequality. It's an unequal distribution of opportunities, of resources. And what we do highlights these inequalities. Because when we speak about human rights, we also speak about people's rights to have access to food, to have access to water, to have access to adequate housing, to have access to education, to have access to a healthy environment. These are the kinds of rights that we highlight and advise or admonish governments to respect, protect, and promote. And we see that the government of Mozambique is failing to do that. So our contribution to peace and security is really to raise the bar and also raise the cost of violating these rights. Now, it's been proven again and again that countries that have a more equitable distribution of economic opportunities are more, you know, governable than the ones that are, you know, fraught with inequalities. So that's how we see ourselves contributing to peace building in the countries where we work.
So thanks so much, David, for that insight. I'd like to shift our focus now to the Sahel region. So Onela, your turn now to speak on that. But we're looking at five countries in the West African region, namely Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad. So we know that the region has been engulfed in violence that just seems to be spiraling out of control. And according to the UN Refugee Agency, more than 2 million people have been displaced within the borders of their countries for the first time ever, which is quite extraordinary. In 2014, just for some background, the five Sahel nations formed a group to promote security and development called the G5. 3 years later, the UN Security Council backed a French resolution to establish joint forces to conduct anti-terrorist operations. Mm-hmm. And a recent G5 25 summit in Chad called for more effective coalition with France. French soldiers are in the region of the south of the Sahara fighting Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. So, Onela, welcome. And you are head at the Institute of Security Studies in Bamako, and very well versed in conflict issues plaguing Africa's Sahel region. So, firstly, how does the work that you do contribute to peace building in the Sahel region?
Thank you very much for having me on this talk. So, as you mentioned, I work with the Institute for Security Studies, ISS, which is a policy research institution created and based in South Africa, but that also covers other areas of the continent. So, in the Sahel, we do have an office in Bamako, the capital city of Mali, from where we conduct research. So what we do is we try and document from a very empirical perspective the various conflict and insecurity dynamics that are affecting civilian populations in the Sahel. This includes mainly Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, but of course it also extends to the two other countries that you mentioned, which are Mauritania on one side and Chad on the other side. The context in the Sahel is indeed extremely worrisome, and I think my two predecessors also described some of the common trends that we see through various regions in Africa. So in the Sahel, the situation we're faced with is one that's very much marked by a superposition, a multiplicity of crises and conflict systems interrelated. So this includes, of course, the tip of the iceberg, the most visible part, we think is the terrorist threat. So this threat is explicit in a number of attacks that have been conducted both against state representatives and institutions, but also against civilian populations for the past, say, 9 to 10 years now. So this situation is also built in a context where local conflicts, local tensions, age-old local tensions have spiraled and worsened while access to guns, while the depreciation of state presence, while lack of access to basic social services, lack of trust between communities, but also between civilian populations and state authorities have all worsened. You did mention the humanitarian consequences of this crisis, with more than 2 million internally displaced people at this stage, but also over 300,000 internationally displaced people, so refugees or asylum seekers. There are thousands of schools that have closed due to insecurity in the region, leaving children out of the school system and deprived from an access to education, of course, but also leaving them more exposed to various protection risks, such as early child marriage or child labor and so on. So the situation is really quite serious. And the contribution that the ISS brings, I think, is to support decision makers in trying to understand at a much more granular level how these dynamics work and how they fit together. Our approach is really about trying to improve the evidence base on which public policy is made, which means, of course, analyzing context and trying to understand better how stakeholders' dynamics function, but also analyzing the state responses themselves to see whether or not they're actually doing good or harm, and how they can and could be improved. So this is, I would say, in a nutshell, the way in which we try and contribute. Perhaps one last thing I would add is the dimension related to strategic convening, one of the challenges in advancing stabilization efforts in the Sahel region is literally to get the right people around the same table. So this issue of dialogue that has been discussed, I think, in this region at quite some length, in terms of, well, who should be talking to you, to who, what should the purpose of dialogue be, should we be talking with violent extremist groups and so on. So these issues of dialogues actually have so many levels and folds in them, which should start with really just listening out to the people most affected by insecurity. So these are local communities, these are women, these are youth, and so on and so forth. So our work and ambition, I think, is also to create access for individuals and groups that are directly affected by violence and insecurity and don't have access in decision making to carry their own voice and not necessarily have to go through various forms of filters and spokes in institutions.
So how do you navigate trying to get information out of the region? Do you struggle with the same issues like with Mozambique and Amnesty International not being allowed access of information?
So we are not on the same positioning, I would say, as human rights institutions. And so, of course, we definitely support a human rights and human security agenda. But being a scientific research organization, we do have access to a network of formal and informal actors, as well as practices, research practices that facilitate our access to information most of the time. Of course, this is not any guarantee, so we're also very careful on making sure that we only address issues that we actually do have firsthand information on, which at times can be a bit frustrating for our interlocutors as well, in the sense that you would typically expect a research institution to kind of know it all, and this is simply not something that's possible in a context as complex as this one. So I think it's a lot about managing expectations also, in terms of what is and isn't possible and how best to approach complex and sensitive issues in a way that both respects and promotes the rights of individuals and groups, while remaining true to our own mission, which is the promotion of human security for all.
Now, just lastly, the newly elected Niger president, Mohamed Bazoum, is he the kind of president to help in contributing to peace, specifically in Niger or that part of the Sahel?
So this is a very interesting question, because I think it takes us back to the broader issue of leadership and what the role of political leaders is in addressing a situation like the one we have in the Sahel. What happened last year in Mali, for instance, with the coup that took place in August of last year, demonstrated how broader governance issues could lead to such a high level of social and citizen frustration that while the country is facing insecurity and conflict and, well, essentially a war, there could still also be other social grievances leading to a coup and kind of further destructuring the whole setup. Here in Niger, I think one advantage that Niger does have has been political stability. So for the past 10 years, this country has known the same president with a very stable government framework and quite some effective or at least voluntary policy making in terms of security and peace building and peace consolidation. Niger is the only country in the Sahel that has a specific national institution dedicated to the consolidation of peace, for instance. So this, I think, is definitely a positive heritage. Now, while the transition to a new president can be a challenge in terms of maintaining either continuity or, in fact, in introducing some levels of adjustments, the newly elected president, President-elect Mohamed Bazoum, is also someone who has been working on security issues quite a lot. So he has led for several years the Ministry of Security in this country. He has a very, very good knowledge of what the challenges are, what the state machinery and apparatus is, and how to leverage the advantages he has. So coming with that kind of background, I think, is an advantage. But he also comes at a time when the situation is spiraling out of control. I mean, your listeners probably know that since the beginning of this year, so over the past 3 months, Niger has known 3 major attacks against civilians that have killed a total of over 200 people. This is something that is new in this country. It's sadly something that had happened before in other Sahel countries. It's something that happened in 2019 in Mali, for instance, but it's not something that Niger was used to until now. Niger has had severe attacks in the past, including in the recent past, but mainly targeted at security forces and not so much at civilians. So this is a trend evolution that's extremely concerning and that makes the challenge that President-elect Bazoum will have to face even harsher.
Well, our time is almost up, but before I let you all go, I just wanted to round off and ask if there are any final comments coming from the countries that you were in. Shavai, I'll start with you.
Thanks so much, Manzadi, and thank you also to David and Onela. I think it's been really enriching to be on to be in this conversation with you both and to see some of the similarities and differences in the context. I think one of the common threads that I've picked up certainly from our conversation is that of the next generation and thinking yes. about the future. And I think what is potentially missing from the approaches, especially the kind of state and international responses to these various contexts, is a focus on the next generation. A lot of the focus in trying to establish peace or trying to change the situation on the ground, as David mentioned, is focused on military intervention, is focused on, as Onela has said, trying to deal with terrorists or insurgents. But I think very little is going into understanding the needs, especially of those who seem most left out. And I think the youth, including women, etc., are a huge component of that. But if we are thinking about how do we actually secure the future and secure it in a way that is free of violent conflict that takes away so much, as David so eloquently put, we must put young people at the center, and young people at the center, not only as those involved in conflict or in violence, but also young people who are thinking, who are researching, who are activists, who are on the front line as peace builders or just even citizens of these places that we have been talking about. Thanks, Hansadi.
Thanks, Shavai. David, any last comments from your side?
Thank you very much. I would like to say that, it's impossible to have a genuine and lasting peace without social justice, a sense in which people feel treated with fairness and respect. It's also impossible to have it without, human rights and human dignity. you know, a sense of being worthy of respect and honor. And what we have seen happening is that these conflicts are pretty much driven by the sense in which people feel that there is no justice, there are no human rights respect in their countries, and that is why we do this work. It's very important because these are elements, the founding elements of peace and security. And finally, I just want to say to Shivai and Ornella that I'm pleased, you know, to hear about the magnificent work that you're doing to promote peace in this continent. And I would like to thank Mansadi and Juanita for bringing us together to discuss. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Ornella, from your side?
Well, perhaps just adding on what was said already, and I think David and Shivai already mentioned a lot. The one thing I would perhaps insist further on is the need for our solutions and practices to be empirically based. One of the challenges I've seen, I think, in the peace building work in general and in peace related policy in particular is the tendency to think that good ideas are necessarily good practice, which isn't the case.
Yeah.
Some very good theoretical ideas can turn into terrible practice because they're disconnected from context. They're disconnecting from local, very either very local or very very temporary realities. So I think we really need to challenge ourselves on the assumptions on which we work, which means we need to include others, we need to include local actors, we need to include research, we need to include the people who will challenge us. And that's not something that most of organizations are built to do, but it's definitely the way we should be going, I think.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for taking this time. As I was saying, I know you all have busy schedules and have a lot of work on your plate, and thank you for the work that you do and for enlightening us on the importance of peace building on this continent, which we need a lot of. There's a lot going on that needs your expertise. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Join us in our next session, where we sit down with experts from Ethiopia and Nigeria. All Africa is grateful to the Carnegie Corporation of New York for supporting our reporting on peacebuilding in Africa.